Today's Teisho will be on case 42 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 42 is entitled, The Girl Comes Out of Samadhi. Once in the old days, in the time of the World Honored One, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained, sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl next get near the Buddha's throne where I cannot?" Shakyamuni said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers once, took her up to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but in vain. The world honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot wake her up." But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to rouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the World Honored One, who gave him his imperial order. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Who wants comment? Old Shakyamuni put on a petty drama and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Umon's verse, one was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil's mask. Even in defeat, a beautiful performance. So this is what's called a koan. Some of you are here for the first time and you may be unfamiliar with a koan. But in Zen tradition, we have a practice centered on meditation. So in the Zen tradition, it's not the case that a teacher will hand you like an instruction manual and say, here are the stages to enlightenment. Do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, and finally you'll achieve enlightenment. That would be possible. It might be possible to do that, but individual people have very different consciousnesses, and it's probably the case that even if you made a very, very carefully thought out guidebook to enlightenment, people would get confused about the individual steps. And their own experience might not match what you say is going to happen in the guidebook. So this is a real dilemma. How do you help people wake up? How do you help people wake up? If you can't just say do this and this and this and this and you're guaranteed to wake up, how do you do it? Because Buddhism is all about the experience of enlightenment, the experience of waking up. And all of this activity that we've been engaged in today is part of the structure Buddhism has created to help people wake up. So we get up in the morning and we come here. Some people got here at 7 o'clock and we recited sutras and then we did meditation for an hour and a half and then we had a bathroom break. And then other people arrived, and we did two periods of meditation. And then we had another bathroom break, and we did some wonderful walking meditation. So all of this is a great structure. You know, you can have a regularly scheduled sitting period. We have a regular system here, right? You know, so every sit is about half an hour, unless the timekeeper loses track. But generally speaking, half an hour. And basically, do we have two sits and then a bathroom break, and then or three sits and a bathroom break, and two sits and a bathroom break? If you come to one of our sessions, it runs like clockwork because it's literally structured like a clock. You know, this happens at this time, this happens at this time, this happens at this time. You can make a structure like that, but you can't guarantee that things will happen on the cushion. You know, so I'm sure you've had the experience of coming in to sit sometimes, coming in to meditate, and you sit down on the cushion, and you have a great sit. You know, this happens if you practice long enough. You'll come in and you'll sit down on the cushion, and you'll just say, "Oh my God, that was wonderful." It'll happen. It's that experience of deep samadhi, deep immersion in concentration. And, after that first experience, it can be really quite inspiring. I remember years ago, a woman came up to me with this. She'd been practicing for maybe 3 or 4 months, and it very on and off. And then she came up and she had this big smile. And I said, "What?" And she said, "What was that?" And I said, "That was samadhi." So, I think she was expecting that after that, every sit would be like that. You know, so she came to sit next time, and when I went up to see her after the sit, "How was your sit?" She said, "Well," she looked confused, right? Because she had had that beautiful, beautiful samadhi experience, and now, she expected that was going to, every sit thereafter was going to be this beautiful, blissful samadhi state. And instead, she had kind of an uncomfortable sit with a lot of distractions. And I could see, she was disappointed. And after a while, she stopped sitting. This is really quite common, I've been teaching meditation for 20 years. And people will come into the Zendo and just have these amazing experiences, and then they come back and they don't happen again. Something else is happening. So there's a kind of unpredictability or a kind of complexity about working towards enlightenment that can't be solved with like a structure, like a regular structure. You need a structure. But the structure doesn't do it. You can't like guarantee. When people come in here, I can't say, "Okay, I'll sign here and you sign there. I promise 6 years enlightenment. And if it's 6 years and 3 months, I'll pay a penalty. And if it's a little early, you can give me a bonus." Right? It doesn't work like that. And that's interesting, isn't it? If you take a chemistry course. The professor gives you content, and you learn the content, and then you give it back to the professor, and you get, if you get 80%, that might be like a low B, or 85 is like a B. If you get 95, that's probably an A, it's pretty predictable. If you took a chemistry course and you said to the professor, "Well, when does the course end?" He said, "Well, it's difficult to say. It might be 3 months, it might be 3 years. It all depends, And did you pass, you go to the professor, "Did I pass the chemistry test or not?" "Well, it's hard to say, That would be, that would not work, right? We need a structured environment. But learning chemistry actually is a lot easier than understanding your mind. Than working through your obstacles and understanding your mind, understanding mind, I should say. So it's really complicated. You need a structure. You need a Saturday sit. You need regular times for people to arrive. Somebody has to keep the clock, and everybody has to stay motionless until the bell rings, even if your legs are hurting. All of that's great, but you can't guarantee that it's going to be a good sit. because the human mind is really quite complicated. So Zen has developed this teaching method, which is really based on the recognition that this is the case. You know, you can't force people to wake up, but you can definitely help them to confront their obstacles, right? And some of confronting your obstacles is just sitting on the cushion, just coming to sit, you know. A lot of people postpone, put off, and generally avoid certain kinds of experiences, you know. Coming in and sitting on a cushion is actually very challenging. It's not just about relaxing. Meditation is not relaxation, right? You know, when we sit down on a cushion, you're suddenly confronting the content of your own mind. And this is challenging. This is difficult, you know. Meditation is not just about relaxing or feeling good. Sometimes when you come in to sit, if things are bothering you, you know, you might be coming in to sit expecting that it will relax you. And if you practice, it's true that after about 15 minutes, you will have a relaxation response. Nevertheless, you know, if something's bothering you, it's going to come out on the cushion. And this means, you know, basically meditation is about facing our obstacles. You know, it's not about escaping. In fact, it's very difficult to escape from our obstacles when we're sitting on the cushion and doing meditation. So just getting to the cushion is really challenging. It definitely takes a structure. So if you came here this morning, congratulations. That's so important. And then we have these sits, and they're very predictable. But, you know, the processes, your own mental processes, and the contents of your mind are very complicated. So Zen has developed this approach, which is this way of teaching, which is to give students what are called koans. Koans. Koans are like little stories that describe a moment when a Zen teacher helped a student wake up, some basic assumption about the world, some basic assumption about the world gets challenged. And the way koans work is that you have to be able to enter deep concentration. You have to be able to enter samadhi. After that, the teacher will give you a koan, and you watch your breath. You watch your breath for a while until you begin to enter concentration, until you begin to develop one-pointed concentration. And then the teacher gives you a koan. It's usually a story like this, but at the heart of the story, there's like a little kernel or nugget. There's like a phrase or a word that you keep repeating like a mantra. Keep repeating like a mantra. Usually, these stories don't make a great deal of intellectual sense, which is a good thing, because you have to process them on a much deeper level than your intellectual processing. You really have to internalize these koans like a mantra, and they go down, down, down into your deep unconscious. And they begin to produce effects, you could say, psychological effects. You know, a koan, to tell you the truth, is a little... I don't know if you've ever heard of Rorschach blots. But, psychoanalysis, they have these ink blots that they show to people. Sometimes people, if they're somewhat open to their own associations, their own mental processing, when they see the ink blot, you know, it triggers something inside themselves. So they'll see an ink blot and they'll say it's this or it's that. And different people respond differently to these ink blots depending on what's going on in their own subconscious. You could say a koan is a little bit like a Rorschach test. You know, Everybody's going to respond to the koan a little differently. But it's definitely the case that people will get caught. The koan will stick in your craw. The koan will become kind of like a problem you can't resolve. A problem you can't resolve. And it will begin to point you in the direction, you could say, of problems you haven't resolved in your own life. You know, so the complexity of the koan is not really in the story. The complexity of the koan is really in you. So what you're really unraveling as you're working with the koan, people say, I answered my koan. But what they're really doing is working through some inner barrier in themselves. See, so the koan is helping you to confront your particular obstacle, or one particular obstacle, and to work through it. And when you get on the other side of that, you know, you're much more open and able to be present with the moment as it really is. You know. So Zen practice is based upon this idea of each person is given a koan, like a Rorschach blot, and works through her obstacles, you know, obstacle at a time, until eventually people really wake up. It's a very efficient, effective system. Everybody is moving at her own pace, and everybody is struggling with her own problems. See, I just think this is really brilliant myself. You know, I didn't make it up. You know, the Chinese made it up in about the 8th century. You know, but Chan masters really had a deep understanding of Zen masters really had a deep understanding of the human mind, and they figured out a way really to guide people to enlightenment, even though we are all quite different in our psychological structures and our mental processing habits. See, so you know, koans sometimes have a dream-like quality because they're really speaking to a deeper level of your mind. This koan is a describing. It's describing an assembly of the Buddhas, basically, like an assembly of the Buddhas, and they're all together in Buddhist cosmology. Buddhist cosmology believes that this is not the only planet where there is intelligent life. Buddhist cosmology believes that there are countless planets with intelligent beings, sentient beings, who are capable of enlightenment. And the Buddhist view is that all beings who are capable of enlightenment will find it, because enlightenment is in the nature of consciousness itself. You know, consciousness itself is fundamentally enlightened. We get confused and tangled up, but it's definitely the case that sooner or later, if there are intelligent beings on a planet, the Buddhist view is that a Buddha will appear. Somebody who really is able to completely encounter the enlightened nature of awareness itself. And so, you know, Buddhist cosmology is based on the idea that, you know, if there's life here, there must be life everywhere. And if there's sentient awareness here, there must be sentient awareness in other places too. And because awareness itself is enlightenment, there must be Buddhas on other planets. See, that's the Buddhist view. It sounds a little bit like science fiction, but I think it actually makes a lot of sense. So, in this koan, it's a little bit like a science fiction. All the Buddhas from all the planets have gotten together for like a Buddha party, see. And they're all enjoying their beautiful enlightened awareness together as friends. But then they all leave, and only the Buddha remains and a girl. And the story says a girl. And in the story, Manjushri is a bodhisattva. Manjushri is a enlightened human being who is actually in according to Zen mythology, Manjushri is the Chinese say Wenshu is the embodiment of wisdom. He is the wisest being in the universe. And in fact, he's so wise that he is called the teacher of the seven Buddhas. He's called the teacher of the seven Buddhas. He actually taught, according to Buddhist mythology, actually was the teacher of the Buddha, of our Buddha, whom we sometimes call the world-honored one. So anyway, in the story, all the Buddhas have gotten together for a Buddha party on this planet, apparently. And then they all go home, and Manjushri is a late arrival. So he gets to the party, but it's too late. Everybody's already gone back to his original dwelling place. And Manjushri is there, and he's late, and he looks at his watch. He says, "Oh, crap, I'm late." So he runs up to the Buddha, and he sees the Buddha's not by himself. The Buddha's sitting in a full lotus position, meditating, and in front of him is a girl sitting in a full lotus position and meditating. And as she's sitting in his seat, see, to make it, it's like, what? Now, you know, if you want to understand this koan, you have to understand that in Chinese culture, women were thought to be, in traditional Chinese culture, women were thought to be inferior to men. And this was also the case in Indian culture. So, you know, when the Manjushri gets there and this girl is sitting there, he's shocked, right, that a girl, a lowly girl, not even a woman, but a girl, is sitting in front of the Buddha in his seat. And he says to the Buddha, basically, how can this be? You know, that's my chair. That's the honored chair for the wisest guy in the universe. Why is that girl sitting there? And the Buddha says, you know, basically, wake her up and ask her yourself. So Manjushri is the smartest guy in the universe, and he has apparently all these magical powers. So he uses his magical powers to bring her out of her deep concentration, out of her samadhi. But she doesn't wake up. And the Buddha says, you know, Manjushri, you could do anything. You could use all your magical powers. And in fact, if there were 1,000 Manjushris here, they couldn't wake her up. See. But he says, but down below, far down below us, there is a being who can wake her up, and his name is Momyo. And just at that moment, a little bodhisattva springs up from the earth named Momyo, and he snaps his fingers, and the girl wakes up. So this is the koan, basically. And if you're working with the koan, and I hope we have a chance to work with the koan, you could just sit down on the cushion and watch your breath for a while, and after a while you could say, out of samadhi, out of samadhi. A girl comes out of samadhi, out of samadhi, out of samadhi. Now, you know, I went through this koan many, many years ago with my teacher, Webb Roshi. And I have talked about the koan many times. And it's one of my favorite koans. But I never knew what momyo meant. Momyo. So I have written something about this koan, and I went back to the Chinese text, and then I asked my second teacher, Webb Roshi, what momyo means, and he told me it meant net of light. And I looked at the Chinese name, Momyo, Momyo. And he said, Net of Light. And then I went through four or five books, and every interpreter had a different interpretation. They all understood the Chinese interpretation, the all Chinese text differently, and probably incorrectly. So finally, I asked Yvette. And Yvette looked at it, and in about 2 minutes, she told me what it meant. And then I asked some other people in the Chinese department what it meant, and they all said, you know, the best meaning for Momyo is don't know, don't know. See, don't know. You know, the koan is saying something really important, you know. Manjushri is the wisest person in the universe. You know, if you're the wisest person in the universe, it's going to be very hard for you to wake up, believe it or not. Because everything that happens to you is going to be quite manageable, you know, manageable. So, you know, if a war breaks out, you know, you're the embodiment of wisdom, you might say, oh yes, you know, conflict. I've seen it. No problem here. You know, if somebody dies, you can say, oh yes, impermanence, you know, impermanence. I understand, you know, I know what it's like to die. You know, I've been through many lifetimes. Everything that happens to you fits into what you already know, right? You're never off your mark. You're never out of balance. You're never confused. You're never upset. You're never worried, because you're the embodiment of wisdom, see. And you know, you could say, well, all Buddhists want to be like Manjushri. We all want to be the embodiment of wisdom. You know, but actually, you know, Manjushri can't go any farther in his development. And enlightenment is actually infinite, you know. So people who don't understand enlightenment think, one, you're ignorant, and then you have great daikensho, great awakening experience, and then you're Manjushri. See? But actually, that is not true. You know, enlightened awareness has no boundaries, the teachings say. You know, so this morning, and actually, at the end of this suit, at the end of finished the Teisho today, we will recite the four great vows, Weinang's four great vows. And in the four great vows, Weinang says, enlightenment is infinite. I vow to understand it fully, meaning I will not stop growing. I will not stop learning about reality and enlightened mind for as long as I exist. Even if I live a million lives, I will not stop learning. See, so enlightenment is really not a fixed state, but a kind of a process. Right? It's a waking up is not a final attainment. It's a process, or it's a way of experiencing the world, you could say. So, you know, Manjushri is kind of, his wisdom makes him a little bit dumb, you could say. A little bit stuck. Because he knows it all, you know. He knows it all. He thinks he knows it all. And so this experience is so good for him, right? Because he's suddenly, Manjushri, the wisest being in the universe, is suddenly out of his comfort zone. He doesn't know what to do. He arrives late to the Buddha party. And when he gets there, there's a girl sitting in his seat. And he's upset because he's the great Manjushri and this is a lowly girl. And how can this be? See? So, I mean, we see something about Manjushri right here, and that is, you know, he's got a lot of arrogance. And he's looking down on another being with a kind of contempt, right? So we see that maybe Manjushri's wisdom is also a kind of a source of pride for him and insensitivity You know, instead of feeling compassion for the girl, he's upset that she's taken his place. See? So that's something for him to learn. And then the Buddha says, you know, you can't wake her up. Even if I had a million guys like you, you know, really wise people, you couldn't wake her. You couldn't bring her out of samadhi. And then this little guy named Momyo springs up out of the earth, snaps his fingers, and she wakes up. See, and the lesson, you know, Momyo, the sutra says, rather the Teisho, the koan says, that Momyo is just a beginner. He's just a beginner. And yet he can do what the great Manjushri can't do. See, in Zen we have this, there's a wonderful book if you haven't read it. It's called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, you know. But, you know, the wonderful Shunryu Suzuki said, you know, what you want to achieve when you sit down on the cushion is beginner's mind. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you say, oh, I know what's going to happen next, see, nothing can be learned from that. You know, when you've had a wonderful sit and you come the next time and you sit down on the cushion and it's a quote-unquote terrible sit, That's a wonderful opportunity to grow and change and understand in a fundamental reality more deeply and understand yourself more deeply. Nothing could be gained if you came in, sat down on the cushion and entered samadhi every time. See? And you know, samadhi is not enlightenment. Being able to enter samadhi is not enlightenment. I mean, this morning we had an experience like this. We had our first sit, and then we had our second sit, and some people, usually we avoid cross-scheduling this space. So the secretary makes sure that the math people are scheduled for a day different from the Saturday we use this space, but the secretary has some health problems and didn't do that. So today, you know, we had a first sit, very nice, very quiet. Second sit, very nice, very quiet. And suddenly the door slams open and these guys barge in and they're all talking. Now, you know, you might have been having a quote-unquote good sit. So you're sitting there, it's very blissful, very peaceful, very few thoughts. And suddenly these guys come barging in and they're talking. And, you know, it's possible that you just heard the sounds and they had no effect on you, which would mean you've been practicing Zen for a while. But it's possible when they came in, it annoyed you. You know, and you might have thought, God damn it! You know, who are those bastards? In other words, it exposes, you could say, your clinging to a particular state of a sort of like blissful silence, you know? So when we're in deep samadhi, we can feel connected to everything around us. But are we? We don't know until some guys come barging in and they're talking and they ruin our samadhi. And then, you know, if we react with anger or impatience, or we feel that we've been, it's like somebody scraping a piece of chalk across a blackboard, squeaking the whole way, and it's like, ah! Then we know our samadhi is incomplete. Our samadhi is incomplete, too small, too small. You know, when people begin to do meditation, they at first need a lot of silence. It's definitely the case. You need silence when you start meditating, when you learn to practice Zen. And actually, if you continue for a while, you need silence even more. You become even more sensitive to ambient noise and distractions. It can drive you crazy, right? But eventually, it doesn't matter very much. You know, it doesn't matter. It's like, oh, well, just some sounds. I mean, a lot of our response to sound is, actually just the discriminating mind. So, you know, if you're meditating and you hear a beautiful bird singing outside, you say, oh, this meditation is wonderful. Listen to that beautiful bird trilling in the tree, right? But if it's somebody banging garbage cans, you think, oh, man, you know, okay? Now look, why is the sound of garbage cans not beautiful too, right? Because we're making judgments, see? So we've unmasked the superficiality of our samadhi, see? If things bother you, you are not there. But the only way to get there is to encounter things that bother you, see? So I definitely am not going to invite the math department to come and invade our space every other Saturday, right? But it was good for us in a certain way, right? And things that bother us are good for us in a certain way. You know, we can reach a point where we can enter a kind of deep samadhi, and even off the cushion, we can be serene as we go about our day, and there's nothing wrong with that. But when you encounter the thing that upsets you, that knocks you for a loop, that knocks you off your balance, see, that is the chance to grow. That is the chance to become more deeply awake. So, if Zen were just about finding a quiet place and quieting the mind and getting a buzz on, you know, samadhi, then this would not be that helpful for humankind, right? That's another kind of egotistical project, actually, you know. But the goal of awakening is to have no obstacles. So each time you encounter something that bothers you, you bring it into the circle of your samadhi mind. And that takes work. That's hard. You know, it's easy to sit on a cushion on a beautiful fall day and watch the breath and feel serene. It's harder to do that if you've just lost your job, right? It's harder to do that if the doctor says you have cancer, or if, you know, somebody you love is dying, you know. But all of those things are going to happen to you, you know, sooner or later. And all of them are part of all of them are part of Buddha mind, Buddha nature. If Buddha nature were just about life and not about death, it wouldn't be Buddha nature. If it were just about happiness and not about suffering, it wouldn't be Buddha nature. So the goal of practice is to bring everything into the circle, see, everything. And that's probably, you could say, the reason we do koans, right? I mean, you know, when people begin to enter samadhi, it is very blissful. You know, so if you watch your breath for a while, eventually you can get to this place that's very serene, very grounded, somewhat blissful, actually beautiful, beautiful. And in the Buddhist time, some people actually thought samadhi was enlightenment. And indeed, in some schools, non-Buddhist schools, of meditation practice, people do think samadhi is it. That's it. You know, that's enlightenment. But, you know, in Zen, a good teacher will never let you linger too long in your samadhi. That would be a waste of your time, and also it would be doing you an injury, right? Because you'd be clinging to that blissful, beautiful, blissful state and not expanding your circle of enlightened awareness. So the teacher has to say, okay, very good, you've now entered samadhi, and now here is the mu koan, meditation on emptiness. See, and usually people experience the mu koan as very uncomfortable, you know. So you've been in this beautiful, blissful place, and now you have to meditate on emptiness, this blankness. And, you know, people can feel lonely, it's like a Rorschach blot. You can feel lonely, you can feel angry, you can feel abandoned, you can feel whatever. And as you're working with these obstacles, as you're confronting these obstacles, you start to work through them. See, and at the end of the process, you know, basically you're a very different person than when you started. You know, so not much can be gained from a Manjushri, right? From being hanging around Manjushri. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't read the sutras, because, you know, if anything, Zen people don't read enough sutras, you know. So by all means, read the Diamond Sutra, read the Heart Sutra, you know, read, if you dare, read the Lankavatara Sutra. It won't make any sense, but feel free to read it. Read the Shorangama Sutra. It's beautiful, really wonderful, you know. So read the sutras. But, you know, the experience or the possibility of growth will come at the moment when you're no longer feeling very wise or very well prepared. You know, in those moments, something good can happen. You know, and if we shy away from those moments, well, that's a real problem. You know, for a number of years, I used to hang out with. I was involved with a group of Theravada people who are really lovely people. Theravada people practice a form of Buddhism that took root in Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma. And they're very much about like scripture. They're much more scripture-centered than we are in the Zen tradition. You know, and when you talk to them, they know the sutras really well, and they will constantly quote you sutras, you know. But there's something to me that just seems so hollow about that, right? You know, if somebody dies, you say, oh yes, impermanence, you know. It's okay to cry when your mother dies, right? There's a very famous Zen master who went to see his teacher, and his teacher was dead. And he started sobbing, right? This guy's famous, this very famous Zen master. And he went to see his teacher, and the teacher had just died, and the guy just starts sobbing. And his students are shocked. They, you know, you're supposed to be enlightened, you know. I thought these things didn't bother you, you know. And he's just sobbing. And he turns to them and he said, look, when I want to cry, I'm going to cry. Right? Well, I think that's a person who's really deeply awake. He's not afraid of crying. He's not afraid of sadness, right? All, even sadness has its place in the circle of awareness, see? So he's somebody I would want to study with. You know, the person who's sad, I'm not sad, who dares not be sad, dares not experience the sadness caused by his beloved teacher's death, that's a crazy. And by the way, the early Buddhists felt the same way, you know. Ananda, the great, the Buddha's sort of right-hand man, was a monk named Ananda, whose name actually means love. And Ananda was the Buddha's cousin and best friend. And Ananda was very good friends with Shariputra. And when Shariputra died, Ananda was who was awake, who was an enlightened being, he was inconsolable. And he said, you know, when Shariputra died, the light went out of my life for a while, you know. Now that's a person who's really open and not afraid. You know, he's like, that's like Momyo. Momyo's not afraid of being wrong. He's not afraid of being confused. He doesn't know. See, in our tradition, Zen, you know, we Zen people put a big... Wisdom is good. Read the sutras. But it's more important not to know. You know, it's more important to sometimes be confused and be uncertain and to be groping. That's how we grow. That, if you're afraid of that, you will never wake up. You know, the Buddha didn't have any sutras. See? The Buddha had no sutras. He went to the best teachers he could get in his time, and they had no clue. He felt they didn't really know. He studied with the most advanced meditation masters of his time, and he thought, that's good, but it's not enlightenment. So, you know, he went through a long period of groping and searching and confusion. And he tried fasting to point of death. He, you know, tried hanging upside down. You know, eventually, he just kept going and going and going and making many mistakes along the way. And then finally having his great awakening. You know, if at some point he had backed, if he had clung to his serenity, see, he never would have left those teachers in his hometown. He was willing not to know. So, you know, I actually think that, I probably say this about every koan, but if all the koans were destroyed and only this koan remained, it would be enough, right, for everybody to understand what Zen is about. Because, you know, Zen is about not knowing. It's living the life of not knowing. We Zen people believe in mu shin, in empty mind, blank mind. We are willing to trust each moment as it comes to see what is arriving, right? So when you come into the Zendo and you sit down on the cushion and you're expecting a serene sit and you find your mind is agitated, what you're confronting are your obstacles. And that's exactly what should happen if you're really practicing. And you know, and you sit. If you sit with your mu shin, and you call mu, or you sit with your koan, gradually the source of your confusion, or the source of your aversion, or the source of your agitation, becomes clear to you. It may take a lot of sitting, but you know, we call this working through. At some point, it stops bothering you. It stops triggering these conditioned responses, and you become serene again. See, at that moment when you return to serenity after going through these emotional ups and downs, now the circle of your awareness is larger. It's taking in what before was outside and what was frightening. You know, so we Zen people really try to live Weining's four great vows. You know, we really believe enlightenment is never ending. The process of awakening is never ending. You could say, oh God, you're kidding. You know, I thought it would be over. I can't stand these challenges, right? But if you can have another attitude towards it, it's like, how exciting. You know, to be alive, you know, we could just be a bag of chemicals, you know? We could be 70, a couple gallons of water and some chemicals, right? No agitation there, no problems there, right? You know, but who wants to be a bag of chemicals? You know, we're alive, right? We're alive. How precious, right? You know, my legs hurt today. How precious. How wonderful, right? I'm having problems at work right now. I'm not going to lose my job, but I'm definitely having problems, you know. There's always somebody making trouble, right? Somebody higher up making trouble for me, right? Yeah. But, you know, how wonderful to be alive, you know. And things happen to us that are just terrible, you know, just really terrible. And you sit down on the cushion and you say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it. And then at some point you just say, I am so glad to be alive. Thank you for this. Thank you for my cancer. Thank you for my whatever. And now that is a real feat. But I swear to you, I have met people who are like that. There's a Zen master who said, he basically said, my cancer is my attendant monk. My cancer is my attendant monk. It cares for me like my mother. See, how can that be possible? You know, the person who writes the... Sheng Tsan, the person who wrote the verses on the heart-mind, had leprosy. You know, he says, trust life. This was written by a guy who had leprosy, but deeply awake. He said, you know, I have leprosy. My fingers are falling off. Seriously. And he said, oh, trust life. Don't trust life every moment, see. once in the old days, in the time of the World Honored One, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne? Why I cannot, the great Manjushri. Shakyamuni said, bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself. Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers, took her up to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but in vain. The World Honored One said, even 100,000 Manjushris cannot wake her up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is a Bodhisattva Momyo. Don't know. He will arouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the World Honored One, who gave him his orders. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Mumon's verse. One was successful, the other not. There's no such thing as success or failure. Both secured freedom of mind. One put on a god mask, the other a devil's mask, even in defeat, a beautiful performance.